right, today is our new moon Sabbath Bible study, and this will be the second biblical month that we are in observation of. And just finished up with Passover, and we have some Passover studies that will be prior to this, so anybody listening to this one who hasn't seen a few things posted for a while should go back and take a look at that. But we've been busy doing our own thing in our celebration with the congregation that came here and people that observed the Passover locally, so I haven't been recording as much, but we're going to try to get back to our regular Sabbath Bible studies, and also have some other things coming up here in the near future with Pentecost coming and things like that. So we're in Judges chapter 6 to pick up where we left off. We got done prior reading about Deborah, and we also were reading about some of the other judges of Israel that were sent. As a reminder, the word judge is more or less a clarifier from the biblical perspective. He clarifies issues. And the type of judgment that Israel was under is always a repercussion of Israel's sin against God, breaking his commandments and his laws, bowing down to other gods and serving them. And this is a time period where Israel, while they continuously forgot God's law, never seems like they entirely forgot who they were as a people. At least it doesn't ever say it that way in the book of Judges. They may have still called themselves Israelites or Hebrews, and knew that they had tribes and tribal inheritances, but they entirely forgot their special calling between them and God. And you would think that people who speak Hebrew, who know that the word Israel means to rule with God, or he that rules, or he that is a prince with God, you would think that that would never allow them to change their opinion. But as we're going to see in Gideon's judgment, as well as in some of the other ones, the idea of who El is, or God as in Israel, is always replaced with some kind of imposter, or it allows Yahweh to be seconded by other gods and be just put on a pantheon of gods. And he's forgotten to be the one who made the covenants with them and made their promises with them. And so that's something to consider in our modern day whenever we think about where Israel is as a people right now. We oftentimes think, well, if Europeans are the Israelites of the Bible, they're so lost, there's no way that we're ever going to get back to where we are supposed to be. But the Bible is full of history that tells us that people who were God's people had forgot who they were and what they should do time after time. That's pretty much the intention of the Bible, is to keep calling Israel back to repentance, according to Deuteronomy chapter 30. I think you can easily conclude that. So, Judges chapter 6. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains, and caves and strongholds. And so it was, when Israel had sown, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, even they came up against them. And they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, or the field, till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass, for they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh. Well, it's good to pay attention to what we just read. This is something that I think every generation of Christians should consider. If you want to go back and take a look at some of the studies on who the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the children of the East are, And I think we have some stuff in the past that we've covered on that, particularly on the reason for Purim study, which covers both the Midianites and the Amalekites, I believe. The children of the East is kind of a general word for people. It would just as well be a directional. I don't think it's dealing with a specific person, but a directional people. But I think the Syrians would fit that criteria because they are referred to other places in the Bible as the children of the East, the people who came out of Syria, which would be referring to literally the rising of the sun, the children of the rising of the sun, from that direction. So I think that you can say that the Syrians, which would also be a related people, all three of the people that are attacking Israel this time are all related to Israel. The Midianites were descendants of Abraham through Keturah. The Amalekites were the grandson of Esau, which were partially Canaanite and partially Edomite. And the children of the East would be Syrians, which is where Laban comes from. Laban's people and Abraham's family would have been from Haran, which is a part of Aram, in that general area. So I don't think necessarily it means just the Aramites, but the people who lived in the general land of Syria or Aram in that direction. It may have even been the predecessors of the Assyrians, the people who preceded that kingdom. But it tells us that this army came to destroy Israel, and they didn't do it in the normal way. They didn't go to war against them. Instead, they starved them out. They destroyed the increase of the earth. That means the wheat and the barley, the rye, whatever they were growing. They brought their camels into the fields to eat up all the grass so that their cattle couldn't have anything to eat. And there were so many of them that it's equated to grasshoppers when they destroy the earth. Now, biblically, from a biblical mindset, when a grasshopper famine hits and eats up everything, you can eat the grasshoppers. When the camels of the Midianites come in and eat your food, there's nothing left to eat. So it's going to be a whole lot worse when you have an invading army coming in to eat your food. It would be the equivalent of strangers coming across the American borders and eating up everything that they needed to eat to keep their bellies filled until they got to Canada or wherever they were heading. And so the same idea is these people were not oppressing Israel with a sword. They were oppressing Israel with hunger. They knew that if they kept them poor and impoverished, they could keep Israel underneath their thumb. We're told in 6, that Israel cries unto Yahweh again because of their impoverishment. And you'll notice, and I think we've mentioned this already, every time Israel needs help after they've sinned and they've been oppressed by somebody, we're always told in the book of Judges that Israel cries unto Yahweh. And this is probably the part of Christianity that we're lacking. A lot of people pray, and a lot of people pray for themselves and pray for what they want and the Cadillacs that they need and the big screen televisions maybe that they think they deserve. But very few people are crying for their children and crying for their country and crying for their nation because they don't think they're impoverished. They don't think that the earth, the increase of the earth has been taken from them or that their children are being destroyed. But in the case of Israel, whenever they're finally pushed to the point of destruction, they cry to Yahweh, and Yahweh sends somebody or hears them. In 8 it says, Yahweh sent a prophet unto the children of Israel, which said unto them, Thus saith Yahweh, God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and I brought you forth out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of the oppressed, of them that oppressed you, and drove them out from before you, and gave you their land, referring to the Canaanites. And I said unto you, I am Yahweh your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell. But ye have not obeyed my voice. And there came an angel of Yahweh, and sat under an oak which was in Ophrah, that pertained unto Joash the Abiezrite, And his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide from the Midianites. And the angel of Yahweh appeared unto him and said unto him, Yahweh is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if Yahweh be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, Did not Yahweh bring us up from Egypt? But now Yahweh has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. And Yahweh looked upon him and said, Go in this thy might, thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee? So we have this man for the first time being introduced to us. His name's Gideon. He's going to be our hero for the next few chapters. And we're told that he is an Abiezrite, okay? And that would mean that most likely his father, one of his fathers, was a guy named Ezra, not, of course, the same Ezra that is named in the book of Ezra, because this is way too early. But that he was a most likely, I believe, out of Joseph, if I'm correct, which is from Manasseh, and you can find that in Joshua chapter 17, verse 2 specifically, where it tells us about, it says, There was a lot for the rest of the children of Manasseh by their families, for the children of Abiezer, and for the children of Helek, and so on and so forth. But this Abiezer is the person that's in focus here. And so we know what tribe that Gideon was from, and that what inheritance he had, and he was part of Manasseh. So he would have been, we'll call him the lesser son, even though he was the firstborn son of Joseph. Ephraim received the firstborn inheritance, and Manasseh was reduced to the lesser portion for whatever reason. That was God's choosing when he chose for Jacob to cross his arms. Instead of putting his right hand on his eldest son, he put it on his younger son. And so we know then where his heritage comes from, for sure. We also know that Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress, which we're going to hear more about. It says specifically that he did it to hide it from the Midianites. So here we have a person under bondage. He's obviously looking at this oppression when the rulers of his land, the government that's governing his people, decide that they want more than they have rights to have, specifically because they're Israelites and they're supposed to live in their land. But we also have to remember that God brought Midian against Israel for their punishment. And Gideon's being referred to as a mighty man of valor. Okay, now the reason why I want to specify this and look at it is because a lot of times people ask questions about this type of situation. Our ancestors, or my ancestors, Puritan Englishmen who came to America, asked these types of questions all the time. Their question was, what do you do with a tyrannical government that's trying to take too much from you? Or what do you do when you live under a government that's oppressing you or subduing you? How do you deal with that situation according to Christianity? How does a Christian deal with this? Well, we know that God chose Gideon and sent an angel to speak to him and calls him a mighty man of valor and says, Yahweh is with you. And the way that Gideon was showing himself to be a mighty man of valor is not because he went to war, because he hadn't gone to war yet. It was because when he threshed his wheat, he hid it from the Midianites. He wasn't just letting them come in and feed their camels and their animals off of what his hard work created. He hid it under what we're eventually told is the threshing floor, which we'll get to. And so, for whatever reason, Yahweh chose Gideon based upon the idea that he was going to make a stand against an oppressive Midianite government that he himself sent against Israel as a punishment. So, when considering all these things, we oftentimes hear people use different analogies for the situation that people find themselves in the world today. And some people say, well, this is God's punishment and we should just submit to it. Just like Jeremiah tells the people, build your house, plant your vineyard, it's 70 years of captivity, there's nothing you can do. Some people say that's the kind of system we're under. Whether you're under a Christian so-called government or a tyrannical communist government or whatever it is, or maybe both at the same time. But there is different ways that you can look at situations from this perspective. And I think the Gideon situation is probably the most important situation for a Christian to consider because of the role that Gideon plays in saving Israel as a savior, as a judge. And so as we work our way through here, we should consider the situation that Christians find themselves in, real Christians, and how God would like them to react, whether or not he sent the oppression, whether or not God is the force behind the oppression or behind the impoverishment. He does not expect Gideon to just give over his hard work or not work at all because he's impoverished. Okay, Gideon does not just submit himself to the idea of impoverishment. He still is sowing wheat. He still is planting crops. He still is pressing wine. Okay, now wine had a much bigger part in Israelite society back then. That's how you preserved your juice. There was no canning jars, and there was no vacuum packing. There was no juicy juice or Welchers. So instead, they had to make wine with grapes. Okay, and that's the only way that you could preserve your wine so that you could drink it throughout the winter. There was no way to preserve it otherwise. It was going to ferment naturally. So they'd press out the wine, drink it as juice, and as it became hard, they drank it as wine. It was just the way that things had to work. It's how nature works. And his wheat that he had saved was going to have to get him through the winter. Now, he could have just laid down and died. He could have just rolled over and decided that the government was too oppressive, the Midianites just took too much, we need to leave our country, give up, go somewhere else, or maybe just die, stop having children and you know, just submit. We'll be Midianite servants from now on. But instead, he puts up a resistance. And as he puts his resistance up, God sends an angel, a messenger to him, and says, you're doing the right thing, Gideon. I'm going to choose you for a purpose. Now that really is a fly in the ointment for people who want us to submit because they say God is behind everything, and if he's behind it, then we just need to stop trying to change the government, stop trying to preach the gospel to the heathen, stop trying to make a difference in the land that we live in, because God's behind this oppression and he raised up the wicked, therefore we can do nothing about it. In other words, the reason I'm taking such a time to focus on this is whether God's behind it or not, which we know he always is, I, the Lord God, make good and I make evil. I make all things. Life and death, blessing, cursing, all of it's his. Whether he's blessing us or cursing us, whether we have good or evil, he requires us to try for good. He's requiring people to try to stand up and make a difference and provide for their families and their nations, not to just roll over. And what you're going to see is that Gideon did all of this while he was a heathen. He was actually a heathen. He worshipped other gods. His father worshipped another god. Okay? Yahweh was not their only god. So God called a heathen, a Gentile, if you will, from the tribe of Manasseh, who had forgotten so much, and says, oh yeah, our ancestors told us that Yahweh did this great stuff, but look at this. He's not helping us anymore. We don't worry about him anymore. And so he asked the angel in 13, but now Yahweh has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. In other words, Gideon looked at it from the standpoint of, I got to fend for myself. Yahweh's not going to help me. He hasn't helped us so far. And this was only 7 years of captivity. 7 years, and Gideon's spirit was to this point already, and so was his parents. That's a pretty quick time to change. Something to consider. 15 goes on to say, "And he said unto him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And Yahweh said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. And he said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me. Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee, and bring forth my present, and set it before thee. And he said, I will tarry until thou come again. And Gideon went in, and he made ready a kid, and unleavened cakes, of an ephah of flour. The flesh he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought it out unto him, under the oak, and he presented it." So apparently, he goes and boils down a kid, takes a young goat, and boils it into some sort of a soup or broth, separates the two things so he can make it quickly. Obviously, he must have had somebody else making the bread for him, or maybe he did it all, and this angel's pretty patient. And he brings it out, and he puts it down before him. So the reason I make point of that is it took some time for this to happen. It's not like, poof, there's a boiled kid in a bunch of unleavened bread. He puts it before him, separates everything so that it looks nice before the angel, and he puts it under the oak, and he presents it. And the angel of God said unto him, Take the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and lay them upon this rock, and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of Yahweh put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and there rose up fire out of the rock, and it consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of Yahweh departed out of his sight. And when Gideon perceived that he was an angel of Yahweh, Gideon said, Alas, O Lord Yahweh, for because I have seen an angel of Yahweh face to face. And Yahweh said unto him, Peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die. Then Gideon built an altar there unto Yahweh, and he called it Yahweh Shalom. Unto this day, it is yet in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Okay, the King James says Jehovah Shalom. Yahweh Shalom or Salem means Yahweh's peace or the peace of Yahweh. Which obviously he felt peace after Yahweh tells him, You saw me face to face, but don't worry, you won't die. Of course, we know that he saw an angel, a vision that came to him to tell him these things, that obviously was able to interact with him in a very realistic way. And it came to pass, it says in 25, the same night, that Yahweh said unto him, Take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it. And build an altar unto Yahweh thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which thou shalt cut down. And Gideon took 10 men of his servants, and he did as Yahweh had said unto him. And so it was because he feared his father's household and the men of the city that he could not do it by day, that he did it by night. So, as I was saying prior, here is Gideon, who has in his backyard, we'll say, an altar of Baal that his father worships at. Right? This is a son of Manasseh, of the tribes of Israel, undoubtedly an Israelite, a Hebrew, and so on and so forth, raised in a family with a Baal altar and a grove round about it, which lewd things were done there. I mean, this was the type of place that Gideon grew up in. He grew up in a pretty bad environment from the way we would look at things from a Christian perspective. It's also good to note that Baal, while we know that Baal is a literal deity of Canaanite mythology and of the Canaanite pantheon, Baal also is a word that's used for Yahweh many times. It's a word used for husbands, masters, and lords. That's generally the three ways it is translated. It's also translated marriage a few times in the Bible as well. However, the reason I point this out is because we oftentimes, and throughout Israel's history, have changed the name of God to things that suit our fancies, and we end up with Lord's many and God's many, while there's yet only one God. And Baal, in this context, may or may not have been the Baal of the Canaanite pantheon, or it may have been a bastardization, a mix of Baalism and Yahwehism, where people said, well, it's the Lord. Baal means Lord, or Baal means master, and we know that Yahweh is our master, and so we worship Yahweh using the statue of Baal. Doesn't make sense, but we have religions just like it in our culture today, where Christ is worshipped through a statue that is called Lord, and different people out of the Bible have been deified in a statue-like form. So what I'm trying to say is this may or may not have been pure Baal worship. It was most likely some form of bastardized polytheism, okay, where you have to mix everything together in order to bring the people into this mindset. It's not much different than what we find today in idolatrous churches who call God Lord. And I'm not saying you can't call God Lord. I'm just saying there are people who don't even understand that God has a name and Lord has become the only guy in the Bible that they understand. So it tells us after he took his 10 servants to do this deed, it says, the men of the city rose early in 28 in the morning, and behold, the altar of Baal was cast down, the grove was cut down that was by it, and the second bullock was offered upon the altar that was built. And they said one to another, who has done this thing? And when they inquired and they asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. Then the men of the city said unto Joash, bring out thy son that he may die, because he has cast down the altar of Baal, and because he has cut down the grove that was by it. And Joash said unto all that stood against him, will ye plead for Baal? Will you save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death, whilst it is yet morning. If he be a god, let him plead for himself, because one has cast down his altar. Therefore on that day he called him Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him, because he has thrown down his altar. So they pretty much play on words and say, it means Jerubbaal means something to the effect of let him plead, or let Baal plead his own cause. You know, let him, the pleadings of Baal. And so from here on out, we're going to see that we will see Gideon being called by the name of Jerubbaal. It actually kind of becomes his title in different places where it doesn't even call him Gideon anymore. Because what he does is he causes the people to realize that this is a dumb idol. And that if the statue was actually a god, a real god, which the people believed in, they believed that these idols could eat and drink and do things, which always had priests that were keeping the function going. It was really a trick, and if it was true idolatry, it was oftentimes trickery. He's saying, well, if the statue is angry, let him deal with it. Let the statue do something about it. And apparently nobody did anything, and they let that try to play out, so his name became Jerubbaal. It tells us in 33, then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together, and they went over and they pitched in the valley of Jezreel. But the spirit of Yahweh came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. So his tribe, his people, his family, I can't even really call it a tribe, his family stood up behind him to come with him when he blew the trumpet. They were the first to back him up and gather with Gideon. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also was gathered after him, and he sent messengers to Asher and unto Zebulun and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. 36. And Gideon said unto God, If thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool in the floor, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon the earth beside, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said. And it was so, for he rose up early on the morrow, and he thrust the fleece together, and he wrung the dew out of the fleece a bowl full of water. So, not like this was a usual situation. God definitely spoke to Gideon and allowed him to wring out a bowl full of water in order to prove his case. But Gideon's already involved in the war, something that we oftentimes forget about. He's already gathered together Naphtali, Zebulun, Asher, Manasseh, and his family, all with him. Okay? Pretty significant numbers are there. And now he's having second thoughts. We oftentimes miss it. And he says, God, I need you to tell me for sure, because I'm about ready to go to battle. I already got an army gathered together. And I'm going to go against this mighty force of people, and I'm getting afraid. So will you prove to me for sure that this is the right thing to do? It's kind of, in my opinion, strange that he chooses, after he already has an army gathered together, that he wants to be sure. So in 39 he says, Gideon says unto God, Let not thine anger be hot against me, and I will speak but this once. Let me prove or test, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry only upon the fleece, and upon all the ground let there be dew. Okay, so now he wants a double proof, a double witness, that God actually is speaking to him. But it says, And God did so that night, for it was dry upon the fleece only, and there was dew on the ground. So the next morning he wakes up to wring out the fleece, and there is no water in the fleece. The first time he wrung out the fleece, and the water came out of the fleece, a whole bowlful. So it seems like Gideon, who he's still being called by the biblical narrator, Gideon has finally decided that God's definitely with him. If the angel and the fire and the rock thing wasn't enough, if the destroying of Baal's altar wasn't enough, if the gathering together of the army wasn't enough, the wringing out of the fleece wasn't enough, now he can't wring out the fleece and there's dew all over the ground. That's finally enough for Gideon. And Jerubbaal, who is Gideon, our biblical narrator tells us, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And Yahweh said unto Gideon, The people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, My own hand has saved me. Here's Israel's big problem right here. So, nice big army shows up, which is what everybody wants. Everybody wants a huge army to show up and win the war. Right? Everybody wants a big church group. Everybody wants a big Passover feast and a big Feast of Tabernacles. Everybody wants a big church group. Right? And everybody wants a big battle. A lot of soldiers. But this is how Yahweh looks at things when he's dealing with what's called the remnant. He says, there's too many here. It isn't right. I don't like working with many. I like working with a few. He says, because if there's too many, you guys are going to think you did this on your own. They'll vaunt themselves. Israel will glory in their own power and say, I have done this. Look at what I've done. Look at how great I've been. Now, it's not to say that God won't use large armies to do what he wants to do, but that large army has to know who's actually allowing them to do what needs to be done. Now, therefore, go to, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, Whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead. And there returned to the people 22,000, and there remained 10,000. Okay? So, he went through and tells the people, and does exactly what the Bible tells him to do. And he proclaims all of the, if you're afraid, if you haven't drank your wine from your vineyard, if you haven't slept in your own house that you built, if you haven't married a wife that you're, courted to, or betrothed to, rather, go home. Anyone who's afraid, who got something to go back to, leave. So we're told, out of this, 10,000 people aren't afraid. There's only 10,000 people of that whole host. And then Yahweh says to Gideon in 4, the people are yet too many. Bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there. And it will be that of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. So he brought down the people to the water. And Yahweh said unto Gideon, everyone that lappeth of the water with his tongue, as a dog lappeth, him shall thou set by himself. Likewise, everyone that boweth down upon their knees to drink. And the number of them that lapped like a dog, putting their head to their mouth, hand to their mouth. Sorry. So 6 says, the number of them that lapped, as a dog laps, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men. But all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink water. And Yahweh said to Gideon, by the 300 men that lapped will I save you and deliver the Midianites into thine hand, and let all the other people go, every man unto his place. So the people took victuals in their hand and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man unto his tent. And he retained those 300 men, and the host of Midian was beneath him in the valley. So, if you ever wonder, I've heard people talk about putting out a fleece for God. Putting out a fleece so that God can do something and prove that he actually is with them. If you ever wonder why that generally doesn't work, it's because God had a much bigger test for Gideon as time came. The fact that God was going to tell Gideon, I don't want that big army, I want 300 people out of it, that's it, took a whole lot more faith than him assembling the army from the beginning and coming to the battle. Okay, because he obviously came to the battle with a huge number. All right, it said he had 10,000 left and 22,000 went home. Okay, that's a big number of your army that disappears because they were afraid. Well, you don't want to do battle with fearful people anyhow, but now he has 10,000 people, which is a good-sized army. And the 10,000 people, they, of all of them, God chooses 300 for what would a man perceive to be a ridiculous reason. Because these people lick out of their hands, and the other people bow down on the ground and drank. 5 told us that everyone that lapped of the water with his tongue as a dog lappeth, him shall you set by himself. Likewise, everyone that bows down upon his knees to drink. The number of them who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, were 300 men. So, we have a reason that has nothing to do with God's law. It has nothing to do with commandments. It has nothing to do with righteousness. It has nothing to do with any reason that a person can come up with, though I've heard a few ridiculous ones, like, well, the ones that act like a dog, they were more savage. They were willing to really fight the battle, right? They were going to rush in there and do what was needed. And the other guys, they were too dainty. as if putting your face down in the water and drinking was somehow good etiquette. Alright? So the point I'm trying to make is neither one of the ways of drinking have anything to do with godliness, strength, or reason, really. So we don't really have a good reason why Yahweh chooses these 300 men, except for to prove Gideon and to prove Gideon, really, because the rest of the people are already being unproven. They're being told to turn away. You have to also ask yourself, what would the 300 men who were left think to themselves? Now, these were obviously 300 men who were willing to go with Gideon no matter what. There was something about Gideon that either inspired them, or they were truly the remnant that God wanted. 9 goes on to tell us, "It came to pass the same night that Yahweh said unto him, Arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered it into thine hand. But if thou fear to go down, go thou with Phorah thy servant down to the host. And thou shalt hear what they say, and afterwards shall thine hands be strengthened to go down unto the host. Then went he down with Phorah his servant unto the outside of the armed men that were in the host. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along the valley like grasshoppers for multitude. And their camels were without number, as the sand by the seaside for multitude. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man that told a dream unto his fellow. And he said, Behold, I dreamed a dream, and lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it, and it fell, and it overturned it, and the tent lay along. And this fellow answered and said, This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. For in his hand has God delivered Midian, and all the host. And it was so when Gideon heard the telling of the dream, and the interpretation thereof, that he worshipped, and he returned into the host of Israel. And he said, Arise, for Yahweh has delivered into your hand the host of Midian. So what we understand here is that Gideon is being asked by Yahweh to go spy in the camp, go listen. He's going to actually walk into the camp of the Midianites, sneak into it. And he says, I know you're a fearful person, Gideon. That's why he needed so many tests. Take with you your servant so that he can help strengthen you. He says, but the thing that you're going to hear is going to make you strong. It's going to make you want to fight this war. And so that's exactly what happened when he hears the interpretation. He actually hears his own name in the camp of the Midianites being mentioned, and the soldiers themselves thinking that this is a symbol of Gideon's sword smiting them and the Israelites winning the victory. And he delivered the 300 men to three companies, and he put a trumpet in every man's hand with empty pitchers and lamps within the pitchers. And he said unto them, Look on me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outside of the camp, it shall be that as I do, so shall ye do. When I blow with a trumpet, I and all that are with me, then blow ye the trumpets also on every side of all the camp, and say, The sword of Yahweh and of Gideon. It should say in the Hebrew text, because the italics there where it says the sword of, it should just simply read Yahweh or of Yahweh and of Gideon. Okay, the battle cry was not the sword of Yahweh and of Gideon. The word sword is not in verse 18 in the Hebrew, which your italics in the King James Version tells you. It is later on in the text said that way, which is why I think they went back and put it. Not that it makes a huge difference, but the battle cry was for Yahweh and for Gideon. 19 says, So Gideon and the 100 men that were with him came unto the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch, referring to the way that they keep time during the night, during the middle of the night. And they had but newly set the watch, And they blew the trumpets, and they broke the pitchers that were in their hands. And the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers and held the lamps in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, "The sword of Yahweh and of Gideon." And they stood every man in his place round about the camp. And all the host ran and cried and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and Yahweh set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host. And the host fled to Beth Shittah in Zarath, and to the borders of Abel Meholah, unto Tabath. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali, and out of Asher, and out of Manasseh, and they pursued after the Midianites. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all of Mount Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites, and take before them the waters of Bethbara and Jordan." Then all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together, and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. And they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and they slew Oreb upon the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb. And they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side Jordan. So what it sounds like is that while the 300 men were the chosen instruments that were going to start the war, that Gideon held all the people that came to the battle prior, and sounds like some others that weren't there before, to be in reserve for when the battle broke out. They were actually going to call upon them to come down. They call for all of the people in Mount Ephraim, for instance, to come down and cut them off from taking Bethbara and the Jordan River. And so all of Israel, after the battle was commenced and after the initial chases is put down, or put the chases started, I should say, and they have been put down in battle, or maybe no one was slew yet, I don't know, doesn't really tell us, that more of the Israelites come out to fight the battle. It goes on in 8, and it says, "The men of Ephraim said unto him, Why hast thou served us thus, that thou calls us not, when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide with him sharply. And he said unto them, What have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Ebi-Ezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and what was I able to do in comparison of you?" Then their anger was abated towards him when he had said that. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint yet pursuing them. And he said unto the men of Succoth, "Give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And the princes of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army?" So it's obvious that these people of Succoth were fearful that Midian was still in control, that a battle broke out, but we're not helping you. How do we know that you're going to actually kill these kings and you're going to actually break free from the army? We're not going to help you, because if they help them, then these kings and their army would come back and they would conquer, or not conquer, but they would destroy the men of Succoth. So they were not helping the Israelites, their own brethren, because they were still afraid of Midian. They were fearful people. They were not willing to rebel with Gideon, the man of valor. And Gideon said, therefore, "When Yahweh has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with thorns of the wilderness and with briars." And he went up thence to Penuel. Now, if you remember, Penuel is the place where Jacob saw the face of God, where he wrestled with the angel. Okay, that's why it was named Penuel. face of God. And he spake unto them likewise, and the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. And he spake also with the men of Penuel, saying, When I come again in peace, I will break down this. So he is getting quite a bit of opposition from the two towns that he's chasing the kings through, from his own people, his own Israelite people, who are in a slave mentality, conquered by the government of the Midianites and of the children of the east and of the Amalekites. And while he chases these people, his own people won't help him. So he makes a promise to both of these cities, both of the people of these villages or towns or whatever they were. One had a tower in it for sure, in Penuel, that when he comes back after this war, that he was going to punish them for what they had done, for not aiding Israel. He was going to treat them as if they were heathens. Now, Ziba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their host with them, about 15,000 men, not a small army. All that were left of all the host of the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men that drew sword. And Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in tents on the east of Nobath in Jogbeha, and he smote the host, for the host was secure. And when Ziba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them. And he took the two kings of Midian, Ziba and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host. And Gideon the son of Joash returned from battle before the sun was up. And he caught a young man of the men of Succoth, and he inquired of him. And he described unto him the princes of Succoth, and the elders thereof, even 70 men. And he came unto the men of Succoth and said, Behold, Ziba and Zalmunna, with whom ye did upbraid me, saying, Are the hands of Ziba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thy men that are weary? And he took the elders of the city, and thorns of the wilderness, and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. I don't know what that exactly means, but whatever it means, I'm sure was not comfortable. Okay? It doesn't necessarily tell us that he killed them, but he did something quite violent to them in order to teach the rest of the people why you don't aid the enemies of Israel whenever you're doing God's work. 17 goes on to say, He beat down the tower of Penuel, and he slew the men of that city. So we're also told here, in this case, we're definitely assured that he slew the men of the city of Penuel. Then said he unto Ziba and Zalmunna, What manner of men were they whom you slew at Tabor? And they answered, As thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. And he said, They were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As Yahweh liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. And he said unto Jether, his firstborn son, Up, slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth. And Ziba and Zalmunna said, Rise thou and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength. That's, of course, a taunt referring to a firstborn son being the beginning of a man's strength. And Gideon arose, and he slew Ziba and Zalmunna, and took away their ornaments that were on their camels' necks. So in looking at this situation, when he finally catches up with these two kings, he has to first deal with his own people that would not aid him and help him. And then afterwards, he asks them who the men were in Tabor that they attacked, which obviously he was relative to. And he says that they were his very own brethren, the brothers, they're the children of his mother. And whatever this countenance was that they resembled, that they all looked like they were the sons of kings, must mean that they were finely appareled maybe, or maybe it was referring to them having good complexions or being well favored. I'm not exactly sure what that is dealing with, what that's talking about. But what we know is that this indicates to Gideon that these kings definitely slew his own family. And so he exacts, not that he wouldn't have done it anyhow, the right that he had in avenging his brother's blood. But he does tell the kings that he would have left them alive, why I'm not sure, if they would have not killed his own family. Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. Yahweh shall rule over you. And Gideon said unto them, I would desire a request of you, that ye would give me every man the earring of his prey. For they had golden earrings, because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, We will willingly give them. They spread a garment, and they did cast therein every man the earring of his prey. And the weight of the golden earring that he requested, golden earrings, which he requested, was 1,700 shekels of gold, beside ornaments and collars and purple raiment that was on the kings of Midian, and beside the chains that were about their camels' necks. And Gideon made an ephod thereof, of the golden earrings, and he put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither a whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house. How good things seem to come to an end so quickly. Thus was Midian subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted up their heads no more, and the country was in quietness 40 years in the days of Gideon. And Jerubbaal the son of Joash went and dwelt in his own house, and Gideon had 70 sons, 70 children, sons of his own body begotten, for he had many wives. And his concubine that was in Shechem, she also bare him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age, and he was buried in the sepulcher of Joash his father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. And it came to pass, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel turned again and went a-whoring after Balaam, or after lords, and they made Baal-Berith their god. And the children of Israel remembered not Yahweh their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side, neither showed they kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. So, we'll pick up in 9 in our next reading. But it's pretty unfortunate that we have to start a biblical story with a heathen, and seemingly we even have to end with it, and it's the same man in the same life, who led a pretty miraculous life. It's a lesson for, I think, every one of us who think that we're Christians, who think that we're Israelites, who think that we know God's law and we know what God wants out of us, that it isn't just a miracle or a battle that's won, but it's faith. Real, heartfelt faith that actually keeps a person a believer. And while Gideon is one of those men of faith, and we know this because he's mentioned in the book of Hebrews in what people often call the Hall of Faith, we know Gideon is among them, as well as Jephthah and many of the other people in the book of Judges. We are also told that Gideon had a snare of something that he achieved by Yahweh's victory, and was given to him on account of what God gave him, and then this thing, this ephod, became a snare. And while we don't know exactly how far the snare went with Gideon himself or Gideon's children himself, what we do know is that it obviously caused Israel to go a-whoring, which means that they started to love something more than they loved Yahweh, which was caused by this ephod that was created. Something all of us should consider as we consider the story of Gideon being like him and also not being like him.